From Raleigh, North Carolina, it's The Leftovers with Jay and Jack, a podcast dedicated to HBO's The Leftovers. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to Leftovers with Jay, Jack, and Mike. My name is Jay.
My name is Mike.
And I'm the woman nobody wanted.
Aw, and welcome to the show. How's it going, guys?
Great, but I'm not trying to be mean, but really, nobody wanted her.
Well, it's interesting because we had our kind of preseason show last week. That was a Patron's Choice show, and I think it's on the Leftovers feed now. And we asked the question, you know, will this season open up with some, you know, cave woman-like opening that season two opened with? And not quite cave man times, but 1844 is where we open into. But thoughts on this scene? There's been a lot of talk about it, connecting with the great disappointment of 1844, which led to the Seventh-day Adventists. But thoughts with this opening? Mike, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, we do have to, as you said, kind of directly compare it to the way we opened season two, which you could try to throw the opening to season one in there, but season one was, I feel, very modeled off of the original source material, and season two is really where they decided to spring out and sort of do their own thing, so that's where it became a little more holistic, a little more mystical, and it seems like in some loose connections being made here, we might see either or the origin of the guilty remnant, or at least some sort of resonance between the current guilty remnant and this, you know, this sect that has no name, at least in the show. I know, as you said, it's been compared before to Millerism. There's even more recently in American history, the whole Harold Camping rapture thing that happened in May 2011. So the interesting thing about this as well is Millerism was, I believe, cultivated in upstate New York, which is where the first season took place. But the director of this episode, Mimi Leader Ladere, I'm not entirely sure. Her name is like that soap company. It's your mileage may vary on the way you decide to pronounce it. But I believe she said in an interview today that even though there are Milleristic tendencies in this group that's being portrayed, it's in Australia, which I'm sure will link into the final scene. Maybe she just thought it was a coincidence that they were portraying this, or they decided to actually displace it and move it down to a country that's going to have a lot more prominence later in the season, or so we are to assume. That being said, taking out the external elements from it, I thought this was just a really well done, like, 6-minute short film. Just the soundtrack was really interesting, and having the only dialogue being spoken is this sort of voiceover talking about the great flood and heaven and earth disappearing. Definitely.
So is that a song that was written for the show, or is that is actually an existing song being used?
Yes, I believe this song, I Wish We'd All Been Ready, has been a previously written song. I believe the great American Idol winner herself, Jordan Sparks, even put out a cover of it. So once you reach the Sparkster, you know that you've really crossed into the mainstream there, the poisoned mainstream of American pop culture music.
I'm calling it right now. How many Leftover podcasts are there?
A lot.
20, a lot of them. Not one of them, not another one will quote Jordan Sparks.
You never know.
You never know.
I'm calling it right now.
Well, actually, if this one had come up earlier than some of the other ones, if they listen to this one and then do it, Jack, I think that is
cheating.
But you open yourself up to it. Just saying.
No, to be fair, there might be another Jordan Sparks reference in this episode, considering that when Kevin put the laundry bag over his head, he had no air. So I think Jordan Sparks is going to play a much larger part in this episode, but I did, just going back to that, so aside from the voiceover and the song that's playing, which yes, Jay, is indeed real, no dialogue whatsoever from these characters. I thought, you know, much like the cave woman that we saw at the beginning of season two, this was all done entirely in silence, but at the same time it was still very effective, if not more effective, because again, if we're drawing these lines between this group and the guilty remnant, the lack of speech makes sense.
Yeah, and it's something that Jack enjoys very much when there's no talking and it's just the facial acting if you will, and the showing emotion without using word is a very impactful thing. And I think all the actors in this scene did it really well.
They're fantastic. I felt bad. They give the guy the goat, and he just laughs at him.
But if you if there is more like Millerism. There's a lot of parallels. It's not exactly the same as Mike has pointed out. Even the director has said it's in Australia, but there is a lot of similarities that you can draw to. Even the kind of weird animals and stuff like that that were on the thing, you can look at on the Wikipedia page for Millerism or The Great Disappointment. There's like that same thing. So interesting stuff. Interesting start to the season, and excited to podcast about Leftovers, its final season. Jack had a lot of concerns that season two was so good. It was such a great season of TV that the third season could never live up to how awesome season two was. He thought Damon Lindelof should have just hung his hat and said, "That's it.
I was thinking of my good friend Damien. Well, you know, it could have been
the tongue there.
Whatever it is. I was worried for him. I just, you know, the whole cast. I mean, the whole crew and everybody. It was so good last year. It's just, how do you top it? So it started out with a bang. And like I said, the opening scene, I thought we had our cavewoman scene, I guess you want to call it. But, and the acting was great. I felt bad. You know, the woman I kind of joked about in the beginning, she's walking away and she's just like, I can't get a break. And, you know, and her husband's leaving her son's, you know. I just felt bad for her.
Well, it seems like Jack is wrong yet again, because the reviews coming in for this season have been gigantic, saying it's like an amazing season. It's going to be the best thing on TV this year.
I didn't say it was going to be a bad season. I said I'm a coward, and I wouldn't have come back for it. I'm good.
But we are excited because this season on The Leftovers with Jay and Jack, we have added Mike to the crew for the last season to podcast about this show. Really enjoyed podcasting with Mike for our Westworld show, and excited to have him here on this one. Mike, hopefully we don't burn you out with all of these podcasts.
This isn't Survivor.
We will be survivors by the end of this, considering all the rigmarole of the podcast that we do. No, as I talked about on the previous show, I am super excited to get into this. I was able to finish both of my season's binge of The Leftovers, plus listen to your guys' coverage in preparation for this. So I find myself pretty well versed in a book that got almost thrown on the metaphoric grill here, considering especially that last scene. In true Leftover style, especially in the beginning of a season, we have so many questions raised, but that makes me more excited to hopefully either answer those questions with you guys or try to answer them and then find out that those questions will never be answered, either of which I'm totally fine with.
Did I spoil you, Jay, on the...
No, it honestly didn't until I saw it. I was like, oh, that's what he meant. Okay.
Yeah.
But...
Because I didn't want to tell you, but I didn't really... I go, well, I'm really not spoiling you because you're not going to know what I'm talking about till it happens.
But I was in New York, not Mapleton, New York, but Long Island, New York, and back early this morning and excited to podcast this season. Like all, I guess, traditional Jay and Jack recap or TV show podcasts, it will have a recap where we'll kind of break down what happened in the episode, then we'll kind of dissect it within that recap. Then we'll have listener feedback. These shows are made better and honestly worth listening to because of your feedback, and we will have that as part of the show. And then each show will close out with Jack's crackpot theory of the week. I feel like he has some good source material to work with this week to come up with something nice, but we will see.
Sure, because at the end of the episode, I'm like, huh? So I'm sure, yeah.
But before we get into that, I want to thank people that make this show possible. Our patrons over at patreon.com/JNJack. You know, putting all the time into doing these podcasts is it's a labor of love. And while it's not something, you know, we get rich off of or even can live off of, the contributions that our listeners make, our patrons make, you know, actually, you know, help make the time, I don't say worthwhile, but at least help in some way, help Jack pay off his massive gambling debts.
They are massive.
But
Jack,
if you like...
shouldn't have followed the pigeons in the casino. They worked well for one person, but not necessarily for you.
No.
But whether you can contribute $1 or more a month, you can check it out, patreon.com/jayandjack. It all helps, and there's different levels and rewards at each level. So go to jayandjack.com, click on the Become a Patron link to become a patron today. All right, guys, are you ready to jump into this recap?
Ready. Let's do it.
All right, let's go. All right, it's Leftovers recap time. The Book of Kevin starts out with where we start out our podcast with arriving in an 1844 town with a type of apocalyptic Christian group similar to Millerism. We follow a family of a husband, wife, and son. They stand on the roof January 14th, 1844, but nothing happens. Town makes fun of them. Head priest gets new message from a carrier pigeon. New date is set at April 16th, 1844, which when the show aired was April 16th. Less people on the roofs this time, and again, nothing happens. Priest gets a new message from a pigeon, has kind of a sad look on his face. Father tries to get the message from this priest. A new date is set, but the father and son leave the mother. She is on the roof alone. A storm comes. She rides out the storm the next morning. Soaking wet, she goes and lays down with the other remaining members in this church. And then it's kind of a pan shot to Jordan Miracle after the GRs cause chaos in the visitor center, kind of where we left them last. Evie wakes up and asks Meg, writes down asking Meg, what are they waiting for? Meg says Evie is much better at this than her. Maybe she should be in charge. Meg shares a story of Siegfried and Roy and their tigers and basically says, you know, they're slaying on these tigers, they're slaying these tigers. Just a matter of time before one of those effers bites your face off. During this, we see a camera drill in. Evie runs out and sees men and black SUVs pull away. And we see a drone plane coming in. And the reflection of Evie's glasses, we see a drone dropping a bomb going straight into her. Boom. Cut to white. So one of the questions that we had in our kind of preseason show was, is anything going to happen to Meg? Will Meg get her comeuppance? And we got that answer pretty quick.
Though I'm going to throw out another bold prediction here. I don't know if it's a Brandon Mike Bloom hot take, but it's a bit of a bold prediction. So you have to wonder, this was a really bold way to get rid of the GR. And I sort of love the irony in that. The GR's whole MO, whether it is kind of this rogue gallery led by Meg or whether it's in its original form, their message is essentially to say, you know, we want to leave a lasting impression. We want people to not forget us. But now they've essentially been, at least this sect has been wiped off the map, which yeah. is a very ironic fitting ending that for trying to leave a permanent impression. We'll see later on with these characters. I think they're a little more screwed up than we initially thought, but there, for the most part, nobody really talks about the GR anymore. So I guess mission failed from that perspective. However, you would think that two characters like Evie and Meg that played such important roles in season two would not just immediately go in season three. You know, I don't think we're going the route of just killing off a bunch of our main characters since it's our farewell season. Part of me does wonder, since they've introduced this idea of spirits haunting people, Tommy has an affiliation with Meg. What if, you know, Kevin, it's not Tommy's biological father, but maybe there's something in that Garvey adjacent blood that allows Tommy to see Meg's spirit and she haunts him.
Well, the thing is, Liv Tyler is still a starring title. She gets like the starring title. So, you know, whether it's flashbacks or she does haunt maybe Tommy, like Patty haunted Kevin. I think that's I think I can fair co-sign that as a hot take. I think it's a good hot take.
We want to go that route, though. I mean, it worked so well with Patty in season two. Do we want to go that route, though?
I mean, I feel like it's a can of worms that now they've opened. They're not entirely sure how to close. I mean, that's the thing with the Guilty Remnant, though. That was another can of worms where, you know, especially at the end of season two, you have them sort of causing the havoc that they did at the end of season one, where they walk out onto the street. It's mass chaos. People are, diving into their worst proclivities, and there's just mass chaos and violence. And so you have to wonder sort of where do we go from there? I do think wiping them off the face of the earth was definitely a way for the writers to sort of create a tabula rasa for them to write a new story on that would eventually make their way into this book. But at the same time, now that they've, you know, provided this plot device, you feel like it has to be used. You know, I do not think that now that Patty Levin's dead, this aspect of the spirituality of the leftovers is going to be gone and forgotten, much like the guilty remnant. So I really think, especially since those that seem to be haunting them are members of the guilty remnant, it would be really interesting if Meg was haunting Tommy. Maybe there's a connection with John still. Maybe one of the reasons John Murphy still believes his daughter is alive is because he's haunted by her spirit. There might be something in there. It's only the first episode. We've got a lot to dive into, but I have to think that there's more to these two characters from the 2 minutes we saw in this episode.
Well, I'm hoping Meg's alive because I think one of my theories was that she was going to be pregnant with Tommy's baby.
Yeah.
So if this kind of screwed me over like the first 2 minutes of the episode, that's not cool.
Tommy's ghost baby. Who knows? Who knows how, Tommy's that, ghost. How that can play
there
out.
You go. Tommy, wake up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember last season, like really, Meg and the Guilty Remnant didn't show up until kind of later in the season because there was points we were like, they haven't really talked about them too much. And we're like, maybe that's why this season seems better because there hasn't been these annoying Guilty Remnant. But once they showed up, it was such like a catalyst for what ended up becoming this big close to the season. So, yeah.
We agree they can't be alive, but they could be in spirit form.
Well, I mean, are we taking the John Murphy approach here and thinking somehow Evie pulled it off again, even though it seemed like the bomb was right at her face?
I mean, it was coming right for her, and she wasn't one running. She was just standing there watching it come, unless she's was dead the whole time.
Maybe that was a dream. She had a dream about it, and
well,
then she got out.
She has the knack from, remember she has those, she shakes.
The seizures, yeah.
The seizures, so maybe she, remember, didn't we think that she could transport, I guess that was my theory, she could transport into where she can go to the departed world.
Yeah, you had the theory that since in the first episode there was that random clip of her and her friends running naked, that when she had a fit, when she had a seizure, that's the place that she went to. I don't know if that's been proven or if it was just, the erratic behavior of the girls, but
if she's alive, then that could be possible that she could go traveling both worlds.
They were killed in Miracle, and if Kevin Miracle. Is any could it be a parallel to Kevin's ability? But
you can't kill Kevin, that's for sure.
And when Kevin goes over into the other world hotel, he is butt naked, as we clearly see. So maybe there's a correlation. He's got a good butt.
I'm not complaining. I'm just saying.
Jennifer Aniston is a very lucky gal. I kind of like it. I liked the story, the Siegfried and Roy story that Meg presented, because it kind of just it very accurately hits the nail on the head of what's happening to them, where they. Keep pushing and keep pushing, and eventually, there's going to be pushback, which is, getting wiped off the face of the earth.
Tiger fights back.
Tiger bites back. So it cuts to white, and then we go to a 3 years later. And interesting about this episode, there was no title sequence. So there was two different title sequences between season one and season two. Season one had this very, Romanesque with the Sistine Chapel type painting of the departed, which was kind of weird and slightly depressing. And then season two had, that kind of country song and this starry sky stuff.
Yeah.
And this season there was, or at least this episode, there was nothing. Are we thinking that the no more title screens in this last season?
All right. I have a small thought about this because it's all about the quote-unquote theme song of the Leftovers. I feel like, Jay, you might speak to this. There's like a recurring musical motif that happens in the Leftovers with the piano music of like, da, da. And the first season, it was just the solo piano, which I think goes with the dirge that was slash like choral music that was that first season theme song. The second season did the same song, but they did like a bluegrass version. I think there was like a slide guitar in there. So that makes sense with the theme song. I don't know if you noticed, at the very end of this episode, they did the theme again, but it was like some sort of Harry Potter-esque theme. It sounded very whimsical and magical. So that's what I think the season three theme is going to be. I do think we're going to get it next week.
I feel
like it would be criminal to deprive us of it. It's sort of like what they did with The Wire, where you know they kept using the different singers and the different styles of music, but with the same amount of lyrics. You'd have to think that they're going to do a new theme song, especially to cap off the final season. I'm going to bet, since we're going into this very mystical route, we're really doubling down on those aspects this season, I'm going to bet it's going to be something that you would hear when you're looking for like music that's from Harry Potter, but nothing that would get us, you know, sued for copyright infringement.
Well, the thing with like John Williams' Harry Potter score, like he basically just ripped off all his other scores. I would say listen to the Hook soundtrack, very similar melodies in the Hook soundtrack to the Harry Potter one. But I digress. I don't get too far off. But so 3 years later, we see Chief Kevin Garvey is asked if the police should slow the flow of people. Kevin says all are welcome. We see a big crater of where the visitor center used to be.
You don't need wristbands either.
We have kind of the first playing of the Sign of the Judgment song that kind of repeats itself a few times throughout the episode. Kevin rides his horse Andy, which is pretty cool, into the town. It has become basically a huge campsite with people kind of in the streets everywhere. The man on the pillar is still there. And Kevin's son, Tommy, is arguing with the two bros and an inflatable Gary Busey. Who is supposedly going to return on October 14th. Talk about dinner being tonight at 6 o'clock, even though Tommy preferred 5:30. It's his birthday, after all. Kevin finds a flyer under his... It seems like a Mapleton hat. I think it's a Mapleton hat. Goes to Matt's church, and Matt is talking about something possibly happening 7 years after the departure, referencing a lot of 7 years references in the Bible. And that is in 2 weeks. He kind of shows off his wife and son as proof that Jordan is special, about how, you know, she woke up from a coma after 3 years. We don't have a kid. And we got a kid. His wife doesn't seem too keen on the whole thing, but she plays along enough. Kevin afterwards goes in and sees Michael on a laptop. He closes it and asks if he was looking at porn, because that's what people do when they close their laptop, is they're looking at porn. Michael kind of seems disinterested in that. And he asks Matt and Michael if they can tone it down. He doesn't want the town exploding again. Matt asks Michael if he saw it. Not the porn. We assume something related to the book he was writing. But thoughts here on arriving 3 years later in Miracle, Texas.
I forgot that
Gary Busey.
Gary Busey had departed. So that was
so it was a good reminder.
I love that part. I was like, oh, that's great. Because I was trying to figure out who was that inflatable. I go, who is that supposed to be? When they said Gary Busey, I go, Gary Busey. I'm glad they cleared that.
At first, I thought it was going to be like some type of new antagonist, like some type of preacher person, and like
that's what I thought too. And I go, what? I go, is it trying to be Trump? I really didn't know what they were going for, and I'm just going, and then I go, oh, Gary Busey, that's right. Oh, man. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm surprised that these guys were going for Gary Busey and not, you know, bringing up two monolithic structures in honor of the Perfect Strangers. Even though one of our unresolved questions, I think from season two or season one, there was like an expose where I think Mark Lynn Baker, who played Larry in Perfect Strangers, was like he faked being departed and he's apparently like hiding out in Mexico.
Yep.
There might be some more to crack into that. Maybe we'll get a Mark Lynn Baker cameo this season. I know it's sorely needed, but I didn't expect those guys as a big BC fans. But there was, what did you think about, I guess, first of all, Kevin becoming the chief of Miracle? I mean, I feel like in season two, when he went down there, he was all about leaving the police game behind. Now he's essentially running the Law and Order division once again. And second of all, he seems to be just throwing out deputy badges left and right, though he does throw out a really poignant quote to Tommy of, see what happens when you make people feel important, which for someone who might unintentionally be building a following himself, I think it's a very, very meaningful quote from Kevin.
Well, that, and it's just, he seems very kind of go with the flow and not as uptight as he was last season, and very welcoming to everybody. I got a little, I don't want to say choked up, but just that there's just this moment between him and Tommy where, you know, he's kind of smiled, and it continued that good feelings that I had at the end of season two, where he's kind of back and he's home with his family, and his family's back together. And I got a little pull at the heartstrings for me in that little scene, that his son is there with him and kind of following in his father's footsteps.
Mm-hmm. And a nice parallel as well with Tommy being thrown a party, considering that in The Garveys at Their Best, the episode that I know in our preview I put up there as the episode you should show people when you first want to get them into The Leftovers, they were throwing a party for Papa Garvey in that episode. And both cases, I think you have these mirror conversations of like, you know, he knows it's not a surprise party.
Yeah.
So it's clear that if anything, you know, Kevin may have this messiah-like complex, but at the same time, he's horrible at throwing surprise parties. So, you know, everyone has a weakness.
Oh, it's true. It's very true. So then we go to Chief Kevin, who has a meeting with his police department, preparing for the influx of people with the approaching October 14th. Gives everybody permanent OT, which they're all pretty pumped about.
How are they paying for all this?
I don't know.
Do we know? I mean, are they charging people to come in still? Or are they? I mean, what's the...
The big question mark is, what does Jardin look like 3 years from now? Because I believe that the visitor center itself is a crater. You know, they sort of did away with all the stipulations and sanctions from the second season. Anyone can just sort of drive in, no wristbands required. But it seems like they're also still selling merchandise in the town square as well. At least that's, I think, what we're led to believe. Maybe we'll see more so into what this new Jardin is like, but maybe they're still bringing income in from tourism, even though I think now they might not be so well known as, you know, the city that had no departures, and much as it was, I don't know, the city that had no departures and then a riot broke out and then their major landmark got blown up.
Yeah, it's very true. Nora gives a rundown of what needs to happen when the D word is brought up, that is departure.
Well, she doesn't need no microphone.
She doesn't. And she has a cast on her arm, which is kind of focused on in terms of shots. After that, they talk about Tom's surprise party. Which again, referencing that he knows, and she says, you know, that's part of the fun, is the, you know, it's just still throwing him the party. Kevin gets a visit, and it's a visit from Dean, another character that we brought up in our preview show. Is like, you know, is he going to show up or is he done? I thought he was done, but Mike, I don't know if it was your hot take or not, but you thought he would show up. But Dean is excited to see Kevin, says their prey has adapted, and shows him a PB&J sandwich, says a senator took a bite of it and wants to get it tested for canine DNA, proving that dogs are turning into powerful peoples to take over the world.
Dogs are people.
They have the finger on the button, to which Garvey replies, paw. It's the paw on the button.
What? What?
And tries to convince him that what he's thinking is all in his head. Cuts to him killing Kid Patty, and says, we'll talk tomorrow. Dean, just trying to make sure that Garvey has not turned, or Garvey is not a changed dog, blows a dog whistle. Thoughts here for the return of Dean?
Dean just as nutty as always.
I can't remember what we said in our preview. I think we were hesitant to say that we were bringing back season one characters, just because I think we were saying they moved on to Jardin. You know, the people who moved over from Mableton did in the second season. It would be strange for us to bring back someone from the first season. Lo and behold, here's Dean. Last time we saw him, he was trying to kill Patty. He had that big kerfuffle with Kevin in the cabin, and then you heard him sort of yell at another voice before he leaves. I'm still not sure if he had his own spirit that was haunting him or whether he was just a little off. I think this episode shows it might be more of the latter. I will say, as much as people might throw the image onto The Leftovers as a very depressing and dour show, this was a pretty funny episode of The Leftovers. I thought Justin Theroux was the great straight man in this episode. And to have like the music build to like this very ominous music, and then to have Dean then say like, oh, I think it's the dogs.
And
then the music just drops out. They've done this before. It reminds me of like last season when Patty's like, you know how to get rid of me, Kevin? And Kevin's like, oh yeah, tell me. He's like, you're going to find this chalice cup that you're going to fill it with your expectorate from the South, I should say. And like, again, it's just these fun little comedic moments that they decide to throw into the show. Really makes me enjoy the show even more than that. It's able to really plumb a depth of emotions rather than just one. So it was a really well done scene. And I think, you know, Dean is going to show more significance in his second scene than his first, but very interesting cameo here to bring back a character from season one. I'm still debating exactly what the use of Dean here was.
Now, is Dean crazy, or because there's always been this dog?
Well, season one was heavy on it. Season two, not so much.
Well, they had to quarantine the dogs. Why did they have to quarantine the dogs? It never made sense why you had to quarantine the dogs. And it just, there's always been a dog theme. So maybe Dean is not crazy. He's dead, but maybe he's not crazy.
Well, and not yet. Spoiler alert.
I'm sorry.
Just, Jack, you just keep on spoiling. Spoil.
I'm sorry. Go ahead if you don't want to be spoiled.
John, we then go to John, who has seemingly taken on his brother's work. With an assist from Lori, Kevin shows up to see if Lori can help out with Dean.
F you, Lori.
John shreds money that he's given, and he's now with Lori? Where's Erica? We can talk about that later. Tommy's surprise party. He offers his wish out. Nobody does it, so he takes his own wish, which seems to be that Jill arrives. And says, this is where the effed up people are, so it's good to see Jill. On the porch, the guys are sharing stories from when they were 25. Matt ate cow brains on a trip and threw up. John worked at a liquor store.
Threw up for 5 days.
And Kevin shares a story of meeting Lori and Tommy in a car crash and kind of jokingly says divine intervention. Matt and Michael look at each other, and Matt kind of probes there a little bit and asks, what do you mean? Kevin looks at a somewhat sad Nora as she's holding Noah, which also there is the where's Lily? Jill goes home, says this is the last time we're going to see each other, joking about the world ending in 2 weeks. Jill references Lily about Nora. Kevin asks if he should ask her about it, and Jill kind of says, I don't know. We then go to Nora and Kevin and ask if the guys were talking about their penises. Talks about how he met Lori and then references how they met each other, you know, at the divorce office. And she corrects him, saying, no, it was at a Christmas dance and you told me that you cheated on your wife. We need to come up with a better meeting story. Talks about the cast coming off in 2 days. I wonder what this cast is about. They get intimate. Kevin afterwards is staring at the ceiling and he goes to sleep. There's a few moments in this episode where, like, he was doing something. I was like, okay, what's going to happen? So he's kind of closing his eyes, and is something going to happen? Because in the last season, he closed his eyes, and he woke up somewhere else. But this time, he wakes up in bed. Nothing is weird or strange. Nora is going
Not yet, anyway.
Yeah. Nora is going to ride her bike. Feeling Groovy by Simon and Garfunkel plays. He gets dressed similar to the hotel and then attempts to kill himself by asphyxiation, but then he leaves the house just fine. So let's break down these scenes here. Mike, why don't you take the first stab here?
Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about is Jill. And I don't know if you guys really talked about it in season two, but I think compared to her season one storyline, which some would argue whether or not they were good, but I think Jill did get a good heft of plot to her in season one. Got scaled back a little in season two. I'm not entirely sure if Lindelof knew what to do with Jill in a new setting. All we really got was the flirt mance between her and Michael. I don't know what came of that in the next 3 years. Seems like she's off to college. My question for you guys is, A, do you hope, and B, do you think we're going to see a lot more Jill Garvey this season? Or do you think she's also going to kind of get, you know, pushed into the background in lieu of the other globe-trotting things that these characters are going to do this season?
I think she's kind of getting pushed to the side. She's in college, and she kind of seems like she doesn't want to play whatever, you know, big family game that everybody else is playing. She kind of wants to do her own thing. She still hasn't resolved the things with her mother, Lori. I think we're probably not going to see her too much, but, you know, who knows what could happen. Jack, what do you think?
I hate to say it, but I agree with Jay.
Wow.
Because, well, like you said, Kevin says you can stay here. He goes, no, if I stay here, Mom will be all weirded out and she'll make me feel guilty. You could stay with him. No, then she'll be talk to me all night long and try to apologize. No. I think they were just, okay, we don't want to forget about her. Here she is. And like Mike was saying, I don't think she's going to be part of this scene.
Yeah.
All right. So another character that I do want to bring up in terms of their visuals in this season is, as you mentioned, Lily. Because I guess one of the big questions, her and Erica seem to be the really two characters from the second season. If you count Lily as a character, I mean, she's not really Billed, but she's still a character who are not holdovers into season three. I've got two theories to throw out to you. So give me A, B, or none of the above. A, for some reason, Erica, since she lost a daughter, is in deep mourning. Nora remembers the war of words they had back in the Lens episode and decides to give Lily to Erica, and Erica and Lily decide to get the hell out of Dodge. B, we're talking about season one cameos. What if the original mama of Lily, Christine, Holy Wayne's initial concubine, ends up finding her way to Jordan and ends up taking the baby? C, neither. Do you guys have any guesses with any of those options?
Well, if Nora had something to do with, like, maybe Lily dying or something, like, I don't see how Nora could be anywhere remotely fine. So I think it has to be something. One of your two thoughts or your theories there, I think, are really good. One is kind of two birds with one stone on where's Erica and Lily, and it would make sense. And two, it would be nice to kind of bring in Holy Wayne, then that thread back into this season. I know Damon's a big fan of these kind of like the Harry Potter-esque bookends, and then everything kind of coming to the middle and then kind of going back out and it paralleling each other from the middle of the story. That would be interesting. I think either one could be valid and probably would be the best response to that. Jack, what do you think?
Well, my crackpot theory was similar to A. So since all I've got, I've just been Ethan'd. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll move on then from me stealing Jack's shadow.
Because I really had nothing. And I'm like going,
nothing.
What this whole episode was just like, what the heck? I mean, I want to talk about the scene where he's got the plastic bag over his face.
Okay, well,
I think that's the next big point, because I mean, first you have to give Justin Theroux so much credit in the world. I mean, first off, just speaking to Justin Theroux, I feel like the dude came in as more a writer than an actor. I mean, he was more so well known before this as a screenwriter. I believe he did Tropic Thunder. I think he did like Zoolander 2. He might have done a couple of other comedy movies in the Ben Stiller camp. But he's really come into his own as an actor, especially tackling such dark material. But all the power to him. I have no idea how they were actually able to have that without him actually suffocating himself. So to have him put a bag over his head, duct tape it tight, and just sit there for 30 seconds choking to death slowly is astounding.
Well, not only that, but you know they do these scenes more than once. So it's over and over.
Hopefully, only had to do that scene once.
And I'm just like going, I kept watching the bag. Okay, is there something? Is he getting air from somewhere else? This is freaking me out. I mean, I don't know how you do that scene and stay calm.
The other thing that I wonder about Kevin, because this episode does sort of parallel the season two premiere Access Monday, in that on the surface, when we first met the Murphy family, things seemed relatively normal. You know, they had some quirks. You have a daughter that goes into fits, you have a mother who's deaf, the father's been to prison, but they seem like a pretty good nuclear family, all things considered. And then you start to find out things fall apart a bit. I almost feel like we got the same thing here, albeit we know the characters at this point. But once we see, you know, Kevin had a nice night sleeping with Nora, no random nightmares, no flashes of him going different places without him remembering it until much later. But then to have him put that laundry bag over his head, which, by the way, when he opened that closet, really fun call out to not only International Assassin with opening the closet, but if you remember season one, there was that whole storyline where he couldn't get any white shirts from the cleaners.
Yes,
and so he eventually just went like super aggro and like basically held them up at gunpoint to get the shirts. So that was a fun callback to both seasons. But I have to wonder, after Kevin's died and has come back to life twice, I wonder if Kevin almost can't live unless he feels like he's dying, to quote another American Idol winner loosely with their song. It's that, you know, he really can't go on living unless he is able to simulate getting close to that sensation of dying again. Maybe he felt ironically most alive when he was dead.
Or is he, is there something that he has to kind of go to when he goes into that other realm?
Or is he trying to go back to the hotel? Is he trying
to that hotel realm? Or is he just kind of playing with it? Like, is he just, does he like tape and then do it and then eventually like save himself before he actually dies? Like, is he playing with the line?
But why would you play with it? Because it's pretty intense. I mean, he's wrapping that tape around his neck. I mean, it's an intense scene.
It is interesting because otherwise he seems perfectly fine, like the most stable Kevin we've seen so far.
But so far his dad's not around. It seems to be when his dad's around, that's when things go wrong. Wouldn't you agree?
Maybe. We'll soon see the inverse of that, I would think, based on the previews for the season. So who knows? Who knows? Thoughts on Nora going off on the bike? Something seems to be up there. Just something that we'll kind of see down the road.
Kevin has a horse. Nora has a bike.
Well, I heard that. I did not read the original source material. I have heard that Nora riding her bike might be a callback to the novel, because I believe in the original source material, the character of Nora Durst, they said like, oh, she was always riding her bike around Mapleton. So maybe it's just a slight call out to that. I mean, there is the mystery of the cast, too. Yes. And you'll hope at some point, sort of like what happened with Access Monday, and then in A Matter of Geography, the second episode, we jump back to see what happened in Mapleton before they decided to move down. We might see how Nora ended up breaking her arm. Maybe it has something to do with Lily's disappearance as well. We're not entirely sure. But yeah, something seems to be a little off with Nora as well. Nora's maintaining, but she's always had this fantastic veneer of everything being fine when in the shadow she has to get shot by prostitutes wearing a bulletproof vest in order to actually feel something, which again is not too dissimilar to what Kevin might be doing with the laundry bag. So
it is, it is similar. That's a good point.
So you're saying maybe she broke her arm on purpose?
I mean, if that's the case, if she could only really get a lift in terms of spirits out of breaking an arm, you'd think she'd be in traction by now. I don't know if it's exactly that. Maybe it's something like simple, like, oh, you know, she has to climb to a high height in order and feel the sensation of falling down to your death. And maybe one time she actually does try to climb a big tree and accidentally slips off the branch and breaks her arm or something. That's just a total,
maybe she broke it riding her bike.
That's true as well. She did not have any, no bike safety for Nora Durst.
No helmet.
No wrist pads, no elbow pads.
She didn't look both ways when she went into the street. She just darted right out.
Well, I mean, it depends on your state's laws. I know in North Carolina, if you're like over 16, you don't need to wear a helmet anymore. So, I mean, it just depends.
But you should still look both ways when you go into the street.
Maybe she don't care. Short hair don't care.
Nora Durst is an empty nester at this point, if we believe that Lily is gone and Jill's off to college. I don't think she really needs to impart any life lessons onto anyone at this point, so she can just do whatever the hell she wants. Is that how that works, Jack?
I guess that's how it works.
You're close to that, right, Action Jackson?
I'm close.
Right, but not there yet. We'll let us know soon.
I will. In a few months.
So as he leaves the house, he gets a call from Tommy. Protesters have poisoned the spring. He gets there, protesters saying they poisoned the water in the response of the assassination of 93 guilty remnant. And they start to speak out the names like Meg and Evie. Rocks get thrown and chaos breaks out. And like some dude gets like hit in the face, like in the face. I don't know if that guy lived. I don't know. But anyways, Kevin goes.
I don't think anyone died.
As the chaos is ensuing, Kevin just walks over. I think
I've been here before, so it doesn't matter.
So he just jumps in, and he drinks the water, says it's fine. It was a hoax or a prank. And then Michael kind of goes in and he baptizes Kevin. Kevin says it doesn't count. We then go to and what's interesting, like when he jumped into the water, the whole chaos stopped, which I thought was really interesting.
And there was some interesting symbolism. Yeah, there was some interesting symbolism there as well, though, because if you notice, the congregation was all decked out in white.
Yes.
And then you have a group of rebels sort of protesting them going through with this religious ceremony. So it's almost like it's flip-flop where, you know, those in white are the quote-unquote good people trying to do this thing, while those that are protesting are the ones that are not in white. But Kevin's playing the role of a Sheriff Woody here, because someone has poisoned the water hole. So do we think that there was actual poison in there, or do you think, as Kevin said, it was a hoax and these, you know, Greenpeace wannabes just kind of wanted to have it be one big test, not more so a prank, but just to rattle them a bit?
Yeah, I think it was more of the rattling. If Meg was in charge, it would have been poison, but these young whippersnappers haven't quite gotten to that level yet.
But Kevin can't die, right? That's what we assume. So if he jumps into this poison water, he's not going to die. So what happens if Michael jumps in? Doesn't he die if it's poison?
Well, he was in like a waiters or whatever, so I think he...
Yeah, he didn't actually stick his face underneath the water. I'm not an expert.
Okay.
I'm no, you know, Debbie from Survivor in terms of water management, but you assume that as long as you don't ingest the water or none of the poison water comes into your body through some manner, you should be okay.
Well, I think he's
splashing into the water. I don't know. It's
quickly it was confirmed that it wasn't poison, because I assume more people got baptized after Kevin left.
No, I'm saying because Kevin can't. So him living.
Well, he would have died though. He would have died if it was poison.
Kevin?
Yeah, he would have died, and then he would come back to life. No, he does die. He just comes back. That's
the difference.
Comes back.
Okay. All right. So. So was he trying to die?
No, he was just. I mean, he was just like, I can't die. So let me see if it is or not.
Why did he have to walk all the way around? Couldn't he just walk in straight into the water?
He wanted to jump in.
I guess more dramatic that way.
It is more dramatic. We then go to Tommy driving Kevin. He says the right about what happened, and Kevin kind of replies with the fake story that he used to cover it up. Tommy asks how he knew the water wasn't poison, and he says, I just knew, and he kind of calls BS on that. The car gets shot at. It's Dean. Kevin's freaking out about Tommy. Where's Tommy? Dean just keeps shooting. Kevin's gun is jammed at work. He says he's changed, and just says he's ready to kill Kevin. Tommy blows his head off. Tommy is shook up. Kevin shares that he should see someone. He talks about killing Patty and her armed guards, which Tommy seems somewhat confused by. And it also flashes to him when he killed her in the hotel room. And then we cut to a dog grabbing the PB&J sandwich from Dean.
That was hilarious.
Again, like such a great, I mean, I'm at this point going to make the bold prediction that I think this dog storyline is not true. So I think it's just a great capper onto the end of this. I thought Dean's final words were actually interestingly ominous to Kevin. You change, you son of a bitch. I think that's not only a representation of the role that Kevin is soon going to be hoisted upon, but the fact that I think, you know, the show has changed a lot since season one. I feel like it's almost a meta acknowledgement of what the show has become based on what the original concept was. And it was sort of almost a message from the writers of like, hey, that season one stuff is not going to fly here in season three. Characters like Dean, who are sort of the BMOCs, are going to be DOA just because they can't deal with Jordan. He's outnumbered. And it is interesting. I'm trying to remember. Did Tommy, there was this, if you remember the raid on Holy Wayne's place in the beginning of season one,
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember if this was the first person that Tommy had killed. Because I know there was somebody that like held up Christine, and I think Tommy killed that guy.
He
might not need as much conditioning as Kevin would think.
But he seemed really shook up. And if it mattered that he killed someone before, I'm sure we would have flashback for it. I think, you know, the little flashbacks that they did were good, but it was also like coming back to the show. Maybe if you didn't rewatch the seasons leading up to it, the flashbacks are also helpful to kind of get you back into the story in the context of maybe, you know, everything that happened before. So as a first episode coming back into the season after being off the air for what, a year and a half or so, I thought those little flashes were good to kind of bring you back into the story. So if they didn't show Tommy killing, because you're right, there was like that, and like he had to like, you know, help get out safely, and I think he did. It seems like he hurt somebody at least to do that. So
I can't remember if he killed him, but he did. he did injure somebody.
But
I know
Mike
that,
would but... be the one that knows the most because you recently just rewatched these seasons.
Yeah, so we'll take we'll take your word on it.
Yeah, and again, people can feel free to correct me, but I'm fairly sure one of the early season one episodes started off with a raid on Holy Wayne's Manor, much like we saw in the beginning of this episode. I think the government does not mess around when it comes to eradicating these cults and other sects that exist throughout the country. And I'm pretty sure Christine was held up by a Marine or a government official, some member of the SWAT team, what have you, and Tommy gunned him down. I'm about 80% sure on that.
So the PB&J sandwich, Mike, you think is just a nice little wink and a nod, but doesn't mean anything. Jack, you're the crazier of the three of us.
I'm calling it now. The final scene of The Leftovers, the final scene of the season three, there'll be a dog sitting in the White House. Calling it right now.
I look at it as a wink from Damon and crew. Damon has a pretty good sense of humor. I would side with Mike on this one.
No, I think I'm going to be right.
Kevin gets home after all of this, and Mary and Noah are there with Nora. Mary tells Kevin her and Noah are going back to Mapleton forever. Mary tells Kevin that Matt is writing a book that features Kevin prominently. Kevin's not too happy. He goes to confront Matt. Michael
what?
Is there.
What?
Kevin asks Mike to leave. Mike says he knows Matt. John arrives to bring supper. When Kevin tells him about it, John's like, oh. And Kevin goes, oh, that's all you've got. Then there's kind of this cool scene with John talking about, I shot you point blank. And, you know, you came back. And it was kind of neat how they had the light coming through the church and how it, as he was walking, it was cinematography was really cool in that scene. Matt brings up drowning, trying to drown himself. An earthquake saved him. And then Michael brings up drinking poison and coming up from the ground. And Kevin says, you know, he's not Jesus. Matt says he isn't, but the beard doesn't hurt. Kevin doesn't like that too much, tackles him. John breaks it up. Michael gives him the book. Matt is concerned because there's only one handwritten copy of this book of Kevin. Kevin goes out to what looks like a charcoal grill to throw it into it. It was kind of weird because as he's walking out, there's other people and they look almost just like static, like they're not even moving and they're looking up at the sky. And at first I was like, this is weird. This is kind of like weird Twilight Zone situation he's in at the moment. But then as he's trying to throw it into the fire, he pauses and stops before he does it. He looks up and he sees sky writing and it's saying 13 days to go, which is what the people were looking at. And we see a white dove flying, not the best CG work we've ever seen. We then see it kind of pans in the sky. There's more white doves flying. And then they kind of come down to this cage that's like a carrier pigeon of some sorts. Older woman takes the dove with a message similar to our 1844 scene that we opened up with and throws the message in a bucket, so she doesn't seem to care about that too much. She takes the cages of these birds on a bike, same one as Nora's before, maybe? Takes it to Mary's Anglican church. It's an Australian nun and asks Sarah if the name Kevin means anything to her. Pans to her face. Yep. It's an older Nora and she says no. So Damon bringing back the flash forwards here. Thoughts as we close out this episode.
So let's start with the eponymous Book of Kevin, my favorite Broadway musical on at this point. Hello, my name is Nora Durst. So I think that this is a very interesting reveal because Matt Jameson, I'm going to make another bold prediction. This might be another Mike Bloom branded hot take. I feel like we're going to see a malevolent side of Matt Jameson
really?
This season. I think he's shown signs of it in the past. Let's remember in his very first big episode, season one, episode three, he beat a man either nearly to death or to death because he tried to carjack him and take his money. I think Matt could show some tendencies where if he's driven to do something, he's going to do anything to get to that point, to the point where Mary says, Matt has basically had me under lock and key. He has not allowed me to leave the town in 3 years. Now, that might be Matt's big superstitious connection to Jardin that, you know, it was because of miracle that Mary woke up, and if they leave Jardin, she'll fall apart. But to have him be so paranoid as to not let her leave the town in 3 years after she woke up, you know, she was a prisoner in her own body for several years. Now she's not a prisoner of her body. She's a prisoner to the rest of the world since she can't go anywhere is a little scary to think about, to the point of where this woman who loves him to death is just willing to take off and leave at a moment's notice. And for him to also almost be accepting of that is a little off to me personally.
Yeah, it's on one hand, I was with Kevin on the, well, man, he like, you know, took care of her for 3 years.
He loved you. He took care of her.
But also, like, we haven't seen the past 3 years. And if he has been almost, you know, so repressive or oppressive, I can see the need to want to get out. But I, for me, though, I feel like Matt, it always comes from a good place for Matt. But, you know, there's a lot of horrible things that people have done from a good place.
But Matt's, exactly. always, but Matt's always done things to the extreme.
Yes.
Well, he's a full-on believer, right? He believes.
Right. And then Mary finally gets to speak, and then she wants to leave. So I don't get that.
They just couldn't afford Janelle Maloney. I think they paid for too many episodes of her just sitting around.
We could have got anyone to play your part. So anyway.
By the way, speaking of the Book of Kevin, Lori is going to be so pissed that she could not get a book deal for her own story, but her ex-husband has already got a deal in the works without his consent. I mean, that's just everything just falls into Kevin Garvey's lap.
And being added to the most popular book of all time in terms of sales. So that's a big slap in the face.
I am glad they did comment on Kevin's
Kevin's beard.
Kevin's beard, because I know Matt had a beard, John had a beard. Beard, yeah. Ken had, I go, they all didn't have beards last time we saw them.
Well, as we talked about in the previous show, it's 2017 and beards are in.
Okay.
Can we talk about John Murphy now looking like he's an extra from the movie Hair? He's just like, he's the hair, he's got a little bit more of an afro, he's got the bigger beard, you know, he's wearing the collarless shirt. I feel like this is a totally different John Murphy from what we saw in the previous season. I'm very excited about it because John Murphy might have been one of the most interesting characters from season two. I think him and Erica were like my two MVPs for the season last season. So to see him undergo such an interesting change in philosophy, maybe part of it is Laurie. Maybe it's, as he said, he's starting to assign meaning to things where he was so adamant about doing that, not doing that beforehand, because he's just holding on to this belief that his daughter is out there somewhere and he needs something to sort of throw his beliefs behind. I'm not entirely sure, but he's the one I feel like we need to watch as well. We'll see, you know, John Murphy maybe turn to the light side of the force as Matt decides to go the Anakin Skywalker route and turn to the dark side.
Well, I think he believes his daughter's alive because of how Kevin is still alive. Mm. Even though he keeps dying, he keeps coming back. I think that's why. I think did he say it in the episode, or am I just dreaming that? I thought he said something to that effect because I shot you in the chest. That's why I believe.
Yeah, no, I mean he saw that, and I think. But if you look at it, we don't know what happened with Erica, and then but they were kind of on the rocks anyway because she was getting ready to leave, right? She had this money.
Yeah, she was getting ready to leave. Yes.
So I mean, if we're just the Occam's razor, the simplest answer there is maybe she just ended up leaving. But for him, it could be, you know, the thought of losing his daughter again. And this is kind of where he's at now. Plus, you know, he's feeling groovy with Lori, you know.
Feeling groovy. Now, the world's supposed to end in 13 days, but we know the world doesn't end because we see Nora, an older Nora.
Yes, we do.
Or is it just everyone around Nora's departs, because that's what happens when people are around Nora?
Aww. Or could this be the older version of the woman from the opening scene, who is an ancestor of Nora Durst as well? It could very well be a flash forward, but it could be a flashback. It could be a flash sideways, considering that this woman is apparently named Sarah and does not know who Kevin Garvey is. There's just so many questions that got asked in these last like 1 minute of The Leftovers, which is really going to open a Pandora's box of possibilities. Will we get to this point eventually? Will this be explained? Will this not be explained whatsoever? And it'll just sort of be left as a tag on the end. I'm hoping it's not the latter. I believe Carrie Coon again did say in an interview that things were going to be wrapped up pretty succinctly and in a satisfying method. So hopefully this will get explained, but still, what a way to end that first episode by just throwing out this lure of this is what's going to happen to one of your characters and seeing where it goes from there. I'm intrigued to know from you guys, who did you initially think this person was when we only saw the back of their head for like a full minute?
I know I didn't think Nora. I was kind of going through all these different people in my mind, and I didn't until they showed Nora. I was like, oh, it's Nora. I thought it was Jack, kind of spoiling it.
I thought it was a guy. I thought it was a guy. At first,
I thought it was Papa Garvey rocking the long hair.
Exactly. That's what I thought. I was like going, okay. Then I go, why aren't they showing him? I kept saying, why aren't they showing? Because, you know, like you said, they see the old gray hair and stuff like that. I go, huh. But then when I finally saw it, I go, oh, I didn't see that. Never saw that coming. Even though I spoiled myself. Right, Jay?
I'm excited to see, you know. And especially with them writing this gospel and everything, and the nun kind of referencing, do you know Kevin? So whatever this gospel was, did it get added or become a new religion and that people follow? And the nun asking it the way she did, though, didn't make it seem like, you know, there was this revolutionary change to Christianity. Or maybe it was because she's asking about Kevin. So there's just so it makes us ask a lot of questions that we don't have the answers to.
But you just asked the question, is she asking, do you know Kevin or the book of Kevin?
It's like, accept Kevin as your Lord and Savior, you know?
And Sarah's like, I don't know. So no, I didn't even think about that way. Yeah, it could have been the book of Kevin.
And, you know, it's an Anglican church and, you know, so Church of England, very simple. Is Matt an Episcopal priest?
Yes. He's Episcopalian because they ask his denomination in his other big episode in season 2, and I believe that's the denomination that he gave out.
So the it's Episcopal in the United States, it's Anglican everywhere else, so that could be connected as well. Who knows? We'll just have to wait and see. The subreddits were going strong. Do you think Westworld seemed to be solved so much in the Reddits and subreddits, so much so that apparently the plot of season 2 was figured out in Reddit, and the creators are ticked off about it and rewriting because of that. But do you think we'll see the same for Leftovers, or do you think Damon's better at covering his tracks as far as where the story's going to go?
We could have no clear ending. I don't know. I mean, who knows?
Well, they say it's going to be tightly wrapped up when it's all done. But yeah, in terms of people figuring it out,
They said about Lost, and they're still angry people.
Well, the way they figured out, you know, the whole the multiple storyline timelines and Man in Black, who's the man?
No, I'm not fighting him. I'm just saying there are some people that were, you know, there are angry people out there. I guess
Mike,
we'll see. We'll have to wait and see.
What, did we lose you, Mike?
No, I'm just thinking.
That's okay.
That's the sound of silence, to quote Simon and Garfunkel, who seems to have a real impression here on the Leftovers from seasons 2 to 3. Yeah, my only thing is that, you know, I feel like in season 2, I was not on Reddit at the time, but I feel like there might have been a few people that caught on to this idea that Evie and the other girls might not have departed, that they might have become a part of the guilty remnant. But this Nora reveal is such a surprise out of left field that I feel like it'd be tough to come up with an explanation at this moment. I think as we creep closer to episode 8 and the eventual end of the series, things might start coming together and that we could parse out a reasonable explanation behind it. But I honestly, as many people as there are on the internet, I really doubt that somebody has already figured out to the point exactly what's going on. There's just too little evidence at this point to really show anything.
Now, do you think it's something that we saw? This is the final scene we saw for episode 1 of this season. You think they're going to answer it on the final episode of the series?
All right, I'm going to make a comparison here to Breaking Bad. So for those of you that have not seen the series and don't want to be spoiled, tune out here. This scene reminded me a lot of, do you guys remember, I think it was Breaking Bad, it was the first half of season 5, I think, started with Walter White, who now had a beard and a full head of hair, pulling up to a diner and getting breakfast on his birthday, and then he opens up the trunk of his car and he had like an AK-47 in it or something. And eventually they did get to that point, like a couple of episodes from the end. I could see something very similar happening in the Leftovers.
Breaking Bad did that a few times. The plane.
But, I mean, yeah. The plane was a big one. I feel like this was a big example, though, of like at the beginning of your season, you show this event that happens in the far future, and then you show the events that lead up to it. It's almost like media res in that regard. So I could definitely see Leftovers going that route. Either I don't know if they're going to go through as many years to get to old Nora, or whether they just say like, hey, here's how Nora got to this desolate wilderness in Australia, and then she lived in the rest of her days as Sarah. You know, that might be an option too. Again, because it was presented in such mysterious circumstances at the tail end of this episode, there are so many possibilities at this point. You really can't rule out any of them.
Yeah, I agree.
Agreed. Well, needless to say, I think this season is living up to the fantastic second season, and according to the critics, it definitely does. I'm excited to see where it goes.
I'm so happy they decided to do a third season. I said, do it, Damon. Do it. Go. Don't be afraid.
But we'll be excited to see and podcast along the way. Well, now it's time to get into your feedback. We have two phone calls. We'll start with that, and then we'll get into an email. Let's go to the feedback.
Listener feedback.
Hey, Jane Jack. It's Michael calling from Los Angeles. I just wanted to call in about the latest Leftovers episode. Actually, going back to last season, the final podcast that you did with the two other podcasting groups, the Guilty Remnant. I'm forgetting the other name. Anyways, it was just really cool to hear you guys podcast with them, because my girlfriend, who had never heard of Jay and Jack, knew those other two podcasting groups, and so it was kind of coming full circle to listen to all three groups podcast together, and she had heard the other two. I'm curious to know what you guys thought about this episode. I feel like it's very interesting to see Kevin try to kill himself over and over, and I'm curious to see how Nora gets to that point where she looks very different and is delivering doves to nuns. The promo at the very end is very intriguing, just to see kind of where the show might be going. And a part of me, as a Lost fan, is just really excited to see what Damon Lindelof will come up with, and hopefully redeem himself in a lot of people's eyes who didn't like the Lost finale, even though I was fine with it. Anyways, hope you have a good show. Looking forward to hearing it.
All right, thank you for the call. So, Michael from Los Angeles, what do you guys think? Well, first, the crossover podcast is a lot of fun. It's always fun to do that with the other podcasters, kind of the podcast of the same show, because every show brings such a great, unique perspective, and it's nice to kind of come together and break bread with our podcasting brethren.
What I understand, though, Michael, is your girlfriend has listened to the other two podcasts, but not us.
We're old, Jack. We're like we've been podcasting about TV shows for over a decade. You know, some people might feel like we're old hats.
I'm just saying. She heard of them, but she'd never listened to us.
That's why we brought in Mike Bloom to cater to the millennial podcast.
Oh,
listeners.
Okay.
That's right. I'm on fleek.
I'm just surprised they're still together. I just don't.
Do you think that would be the breaking point for a relationship? Ordinarily,
I think that would be. I would think that would be it. I'm kidding, of course.
So, you know, the end of Lost kind of tormented Damon a lot, and I think unfairly so, but I think he took on a lot of pressure for that, on a lot of fights over Twitter, quit Twitter because of it.
Which was ridiculous, because he was funny on Twitter.
So one of the things that I think Damon Lindelof has done well in his career is kind of writing these story arcs for characters where they kind of redeemed themselves in the end. Will this season be Damon Lindelof's redemption story arc?
I'm going to say yes. I have full confidence in him.
Yeah,
you didn't want to try it, Jack. Sorry.
I said I was afraid for him. You know how angry people can be.
Sorry to jump over you, Mike.
No problem at all. I mean, I do feel like, again, we've been getting so much press from the cast and crew about how enjoyable this finale is. Part of me wonders if they are overcompensating, considering that, yes, the other big project that has Damon Lindelof's name linked to it might have produced, with in the case of some people, an unsatisfying ending. I'm actually in the category of our caller as well, in that I did enjoy the Lost finale, though I'm probably in a minority there. I think, you know, there's a lot riding on him to really close out the story well. But I have trust, you know, if we even counted the season two finale as the finale, the series finale of The Leftovers, I thought that really ended the series if it needed to in a really fantastic and poignant way. So I have full confidence that with 8 episodes, he's going to make this ending even better. And that's just me being an optimist in life. But I really have confidence in Damon here.
Well, at that point, they didn't know if they were coming back for season three, right? They didn't know if they had
Yeah, so I thought it was
perfect. I just thought,
well, I think Damon's learned from, you know, if you want to call them mistakes of Lost, where you know, the whole time that he podcasted him and Carlton podcasted about the show and would talk about the show after each episode,
Lost was unfair. I mean, it was a new world. It was a show that people picked apart. We've talked about it a thousand times, scene by scene. But there was no way they were going to please everybody.
I think they learned was, like, in, you know, the season two, season three, like when they would do that podcast and they would say, like, don't worry, you're going to have answers to all of these things. And then for those, like, rabid diehard fans for all of these mysteries, they're never going to be able to answer. And again, I can go back and kind of, you can answer just about every, thing that people think are plot holes.
Rose and Bernard.
No, that's silly. I think in this show, it's been very straightforward with, you know, like with the departure, like in the beginning, it's like, we're not going to answer why that happened. You're not going to get an answer for it. Don't go into the show thinking, you want to get the answer to why they all departed or what made them depart.
Yeah. They said that, I think, before the episode aired. Didn't they?
So I think there is lessons learned there in terms of what he's done with this show, and how he has constructed it but also making it, still have that, I think something that Damon explores in all of everything that I've seen him do is this. There's a lot of religious subtext, you know, creationism and all these kinds of things, like with Prometheus and kind of the creation of our species, was brought up in that. And in this show, you definitely see him exploring, you know, these different ideas of faith. Organized religion, and I think he's learned from lessons, and two, I think he's already had the successful ending to the show, like we've talked about with season two, and if the indication from the reviewers and what I've seen so far of season three, I have no doubt that he'll be able to land that plane.
Is Frank Lapidus flying that ending then?
It's like my plane joke.
Jay almost killed him.
Oh, Lapidus? Oh, yeah, the actor. Yeah. All right, we have another call. Let's get into it now.
Hey, Jay and Jack and Mike. My name is Scarlett. I've been so excited for season three to come, and the first episode did not disappoint. I've been rewatching the episode today, and I'm just so impressed by the opening scene where the woman from 1844 wants so desperately to be taken in the rapture. I'm active on the Leftover subreddit, and a few people have posted that the scene is based on the Great Disappointment of 1844, which eventually led to the development of the Seventh-day Adventists. Again, the number 7 comes up in this episode. But there are a few interesting things about the scene. One, it draws parallels to this woman's faith and her world, where the community is anticipating a departure situation and it never comes. On the contrast, there's the world of the Garveys, which had people disappear in the departure and nobody anticipated or wanted it. The Leftovers trailers keep alluding to this idea that they're expecting a large flood. I don't know if that's a spoiler, I'm sorry, but it's in the trailers. or some kind of end of the world, which is in the episode, on October 14th, 7 years from the actual departure. But maybe it'll be like this woman's world where people anticipate the end and it doesn't happen because it never really happens when you anticipate it. Anyway, my favorite part of the scene is the fact that at the end, when she's left standing alone in the rain, waiting for the rapture, being mocked by her neighbors. She walks into the church and lays down with what I think are corpses that are likely to be buried. That's my interpretation. And if I'm right, maybe it's a foreshadow about the fate of the guilty remnant, which happens seconds later. Regardless of what those bodies were, I interpret it as the woman being some kind of like original guilty remnant, where the guilty remnant are a group of people who are alone, in pain, feeling left behind. And so is this woman. The song during this entire scene was so upbeat. It was creepy. Anyway, I love listening to you guys, and I've been enjoying your Westworld podcast as well. So thanks for all your hard work, and have a great week. Thanks.
All right, Scarlett, thank you for the call.
Great call.
So a few things on that. First, I didn't point this out, but there was so much affiliation with the number 7. Guess what 7 rhymes with?
Heaven.
And?
Hell.
No. And
Kevin.
There you go. Really, I'm glad I'm making an impression here by bringing up the groundbreaking theory that 7 rhymes with Kevin. Going Sesame Street here on the Leftovers podcast. I think Scarlett brings up some really interesting points there. This scene to me really resonated with the quote that Matt says later, which is another humorous moment where he basically says, in a roundabout way of speaking, you know, if you come to me but will not leave your family, you cannot be my follower. And Kevin's like, oh, did I say that? He's like, no, it's from Jesus. Which again is another really humorous moment. Line, yeah. But I think it really represents not only the struggle of this woman that we saw in this first scene where her family abandoned her, but she stayed true to her faith, but that's what Lori Garvey went through. You know, she ended up disavowing both her and Meg ended up disavowing everyone that they loved in order to join the guilty remnant. You could argue it might be setting up what's going to happen with Kevin here. If he again is going to be leading this sect, that maybe he is going to, as a result, have to push out everyone that he's just recently over the past 3 years brought back into his life in order to really lead entirely. And maybe these other characters have to do so as well. Matt just got rid of his immediate family in order to become a follower of Kevin, it seems. So I feel like it's a really pertinent quote. I don't know exactly if it's a direct ancestor of the guilty remnant, but like Scarlett said, I think there are themes that hold of, you know, groups of people that feel that they're left behind, and as a result, they feel more callous and independent in the world, which I think also goes to show again that these groups come and go. You know, that we have a group in 1844 that's only really talked about in comparison to the Leftovers. Then we have the Guilty Remnant, who quite literally get wiped off the face of Jardin, Texas. Shows that, you know, these things can almost be flash in the pan, but the ideals really resonate throughout. I don't know what to think about this idea that she was going to lay down with a bunch of dead bodies. Yeah. I thought that was the remaining group of these people.
Yeah.
Though, considering how few of them were left during that last sermon, it could be a group of casualties who, you know, maybe they decided to go. What was that group of people who all wore the Nikes, drank the poison punch, that were thinking Haley's Comet was going to come and take them away?
Yeah, San Diego.
Yeah, it wasn't Haley's Comet. It was like was it Hale Bob or something like that?
Hale Bob Comet.
Yeah.
It was 39 of them, I think. It was nice house.
It would be interesting if it was a mass suicide. It's a good call out. That'll be the next flashback to actually follow that cult.
My first thought was that she was laying down next to dead bodies.
Mm.
But
or even like, I mean, it almost seemed like mannequins, which again in 1844 didn't have those. But it did seem kind of like weird.
Maybe it was their only friends she could have.
Unless if this really was the ancestor to the GR, they first came up with the big season 1 plan of let's take mannequins of our family members and put them in the houses with us.
Yeah, that was nice of them to do that. that was probably the worst thing they did.
What the whole?
I mean, that was a pretty bad one. I don't know how I feel about the dead grenade in the bus full of school children. I think that was definitely the first sign that like Meg was a little bit off the deep end.
Kids get over that. I'm just the whole thing.
No. Kids do not get over that. Okay.
It's like today you just have the guy go, you've been pranked. You know, so just something like that. But no, I think your family's departed. You haven't seen your loved ones, and they bring lifelike bot. I mean, come on. That was cruel. I forgot about the grenade part. That's probably a close second.
Oh, man. But yeah, and so her thoughts of it being kind of the inverse of the people being prepared and not prepared. So is this flood going to happen or not going to happen?
I don't think the flood is going to happen. I think something of a smaller scale is going to happen in 13 days that will drastically affect our characters.
Interesting. Interesting. Jack, your thoughts.
I think something, again, something major is going to happen. I agree. Maybe not a flood, but yeah, something major will happen. It has to. I mean, wouldn't you think it'd have to?
I mean, who knows? It could go either way. And this, again, that last scene kind of supports Scarlet's theory there, in that, you know, the flood doesn't happen and kills all the people because, you know, maybe Australia was like the lone area that was saved from the flood. Who knows? But you don't know.
As crazy as Matt is, and as over the top as he usually has his finger on the pulse of what's going to happen, though, doesn't he? I mean, for the most part, doesn't he have? Sometimes. And Michael seems pretty level-headed, right? He's not on the computer doing porn, right? Watching porn, he's writing the
book
of Kevin.
Unless maybe Michael's division of the book is for him to write the Kevin Garvey fan fiction section of it.
That could be it.
Kevin slid out of the bathtub, his gleaming butt shining in the light of the bathroom.
Yeah. So what's the Kevin Shippers there? What I mean, there's a lot of different options.
You call him the Kev heads, and then like Michael's just taking like, ooh, let's see what Kevin Garvey and Shrek would be like if they hooked up. There's a I don't know if you guys realize there's a very weird corner of the internet, and there are many weird corners of the internet, but one in particular is all about like shipping Shrek and Sonic the Hedgehog together for some reason.
What?
So again, I have no idea what recesses exist in Michael's mind.
I don't get out much. I'd never heard of this.
Oh man. All right. Well, again, thank you for the calls. If you listening right now like to call in after next week's episode or any time about any of these episodes, even previous seasons, any theories
anytime
you have, questions, comments, and or theories, give us a call at 385-309-0311. Call
any time.
Let's go to the emails here. This email is titled The Book of Jack. Not really. Hello. So excited for the show and for the podcast. I know there will be a lot of feedback, so I'll keep it short, kind of. I have a glaring issue with Mike's watching order of the first season. So this was on our preview episode where Mike said starting with episode 9, right, as the
yes
first one? Giving away a huge piece of Laurie's reason for joining the GR and also seeing Patty as Laurie's patient first. If you watch the Garveys at their best before season, you spoil a lot of those characters' arcs. There is so much with the Book of Kevin. I just want to point out one thing about it and one thing about what we see in the previews for the season. One, we know Kevin doesn't destroy the book. Look at his friends, a.k.a. Apostles, faces, Michael, Matt, and John. When they interact, while he's trying to act like he isn't a big deal, I feel like I can see that there's a part of him that definitely enjoys the attention from those guys, as long as they don't come right out and say it. Not wanting to dive into the Messiah thing full on, but vanity's a bitch. Another one. Is Tommy experiencing what it was like for Kevin having to watch his father go crazy after the initial departure? Also, in the previews, we see Nora leaving. Is she trying to pull a scam that we have seeing her talk about before, departing herself to Australia with money, a movie type? I would have worked and seen these people who fake depart screw up, so I know we're not to go wrong kind of thing. Money hidden on her body, laying in a cargo crate shots. This is going to be fun. Interesting to hear your thoughts. Imitation Lego Ethan number 4. P.S. I would like a new theme song. I wonder if that was just for the first episode because 1844 was so intense. But the no new credit song thing would be a strong statement in and of itself. The Ethan.
All right. Well, I guess Ethan has now earned a new enemy in me. So Jack and I are allied against
there,
Ethan.
There we
point
go.
No,
you
no.
We think by after this season, the leftovers, Jay will also be...
Yes, we'll all be firmly anti-Ethan. No, I totally respect his opinion with
no,
my
no,
hot take
no,
that I had
no
about. I'm playing the diplomat here, Jack. No, I'm not the international assassin. I chose the diplomat outfit out of my closet. That.
No, you say, no, I'm right, you're wrong, Ethan. That's how you say it.
I mean, I think that, yes, you do lose out on some of those big reveals, like Lori's baby having been departed and all that. So I understand that initial surprise. But again, I'm just going to go back to my main point that I think in terms of tone, the pilot is just so damn dour. And I would argue it's probably the worst episode of The Leftovers in terms of it being very scattered. And there's not an modicum of joy out of it. And that's not what The Leftovers is about. The Leftovers is not a depressing show. It's actually become a little joyful and a little hopeful as well. I mean, the AV Club in the review called this the most hopeful show about the most somber subject. And I feel like the first episode doesn't necessarily represent that. I do agree there might be some surprises that will be given away later on. But that being said, if we do have Patty as the first patient, you do get an interesting warp of perspective there, seeing her become the leader of the guilty remnant. Yes, you do have the mystery immediately revealed about who Patty is and her relation to Lori, but then you sort of see, like, oh, this is fun to have, you know, a victim of abuse and someone who was, you know, replying into Lori, to have her then become Lori's superior is an interesting power shift. But again, my prerogative, totally understand if you don't want to go in that direction, but that's my opinion and I'm sticking to it.
There you go. Good job.
No, I would agree, because it's so tough. I almost wish for Damon, he could have just used the book as a source material and then just kind of do his own thing. Because I think the first season followed the book so much that he couldn't really break free from what the book was trying to do. And then in season two, where there wasn't any book as the framework for what it should be, that's when the show kind of really was able to take on this different life that I think made it incredible compared to season one, which was it was an interesting story. It was this compelling drama and, you know, interesting characters, but it was not something that was necessarily an enjoyable good time.
We talked about it 100 times. That is the biggest problem with trying to get people into The Leftovers is getting them through those first couple episodes, because it is depressing. But that's why I say just skip season one, go to season two, then come back and watch season one.
And while, but that's why I do like Mike's little machete edit there in putting episode 9. So I am not going to fight with Ethan here, but I'm going to back up.
Well, I'm going to say now that I know Ethan's against it, I'm all for starting on episode 9.
Shouldn't have showed your cards there, Ethan. Do we have anything about his questions/thoughts here? I guess as a reminder, one is that Kevin might give in to some of his more vain impulses eventually and decides to, even though he refuses it at first, to eventually give in to the Messiah complex. Two is that there might be some parallels with Tommy experiencing, you know, a father going crazy. Granted, it's an adopted father, but still what we saw happen with Kevin and Papa Garvey. And the third one is, you know, based on Nora and the previews, exactly what she's doing in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up the parallels earlier in this episode, Mike, about throwing the surprise party for Kevin's dad, and then in this episode, throwing the surprise party for Tommy. It's a good literary technique, it's a good writing technique, and it would be an interesting thing to play out for Tommy's story arc if he gets a meaty story arc this season.
Yeah, I think that's a big if. And again, we talked about this with Jill. I'm glad we're seeing more of Tommy, because let's remember last season he had 2 episodes. So did Lori as well. And I don't know if he's going to be traveling with them to Australia. Things might become a little more upended there. So we'll see exactly what Tommy's actions are this season. But yeah, it would be really interesting, since we really don't know that much of Papa Garvey. Hopefully we'll find out more about him when they go to Australia. But if we're starting to see similar narratives carry out, that could be a very fun theme to tackle, of generations, and does history have a habit of repeating itself?
We'll have to see. Jack, what do you think?
I don't know. More of, do we want more of Tommy? I don't know.
I don't think it's necessary, but
there was a lot of Tommy in season one.
Yes.
And honestly, the Holy Wayne story was kind of one of my favorite things from season one.
Yeah. Probably one of the, yeah, I would say the Holy Wayne stuff, as weird as it was, plus the Nora and Matt stuff, was probably the best part of season one, honestly.
Agreed. Agreed 100%. 100%. The twins, the worst part.
And the twins.
Twins. Yeah. Do we want to speculate on a lot of stuff we saw in the previews, which had a lot of the Nora's stuff that Ethan brought up in this email, or do we want to like let it play out?
Maybe we should, just to not get too spoilery into it. Again, we have a bunch of episodes moving forward. Let's put a pin in that as well and just maybe come back to it if and when we see exactly what Nora is doing. I think it's a really interesting theory to have Nora sort of be a buster for some of these fake departures, or her staging her own fake departure for one reason or another. As we talked about before, it seems like she might be up to some shady stuff behind the scenes, and it's going to lead her somehow, at least we're assuming, into her becoming this sort of dove cradling hermit in the wilds of Australia. So we're not entirely sure how we're going to get from point A to B, but this could be a possible explanation as to how we got there.
But does she, okay, if she's faking her own departure, she's faking her own, does she leave because, and she changes her name and she says, I don't know Kevin, because everyone seems to die or disappear when they're around her.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the only reason she would do it.
We talked about it in the preview, this idea that in the Lens episode, that as crazy as the theory was that Nora laughed it off when they were talking about like the demon Azrael, that this whole idea that she was a Lens, in that she's not being directly affected by things, but everyone around her is. It's almost like, you know, with mono, some people are carriers and are never affected by the illness, but they're able to pass it on to others who do get afflicted by the illness. So Nora, as a result, is sort of, could be in a way almost cursing everyone around her. First, her family departs. The family that she's in right now has a very interesting story to them as well. We don't know what happened with Lily. There could be something in there as well that would cause her to say, like, F this. I'm just going to go off to the most remote corner of the earth where I really can't affect any person. Let me fake my own death or my own departure, essentially, to be able to get there.
Yeah.
All right.
That's true. It's very true. We will put a pin in it in terms of a larger discussion, because I'm sure we will see it as the season goes on. Thank you, Ethan. Look forward to more emails from you as the season goes on. One last quick email here from Mandy. Question is, if you were Tommy, what would your wish have been?
That Meg was still alive.
My wish would have been that my dad would have had the sloppiest hookup with Shrek, and it all got written down in a nice little addendum to the Book of Kevin.
We didn't even talk about it. He looks at Nora. Didn't he look at Nora and say, do you want it? Like the wish?
Nora kind of just goes like, whatever you want, honey. Like, it's your wish.
Whatever you want.
The question is, does this wish get counted, considering that he blew out the trick candles, which technically do not go out? Does a wish get counted in that perspective?
I think it does. It takes more work to do that, right?
His wish was for Jill. Product. He said when Jill got, he's like, hey, my wish was answered. So that it was his wish. But, yeah.
What would Nora's wish have been?
Maybe we'll find out, and we see whatever play she is playing.
Passport to Australia.
a bunch of cash you can strap to herself. But anywho, thank you again for your guys' feedback. You can email us at leftoversjj@gmail.com, just the letters JJ. Sorry, Mike, that email was made before you joined the show.
It's fine. I'm part of the departed. I am invisible, but I'm still a living reminder of the new addition, unlike the departure, to this podcast.
Or give us a call at 385-309-0311. If you email the old Lost Podcast email, we'll pull it from there, too. Now it is time to get into the momentous occasion of each episode, which, honestly, Jack has gotten so lazy at Crackpot Theories, they're usually somebody will figure him out before it actually gets to the Crackpot Theory.
As a famous iTunes reviewer said, I'm just phoning it in at this point. So,
which I couldn't
argue with. So,
Jack, are you ready for your Crackpot Theory of the Week?
Yeah.
All right, let me get the drum set ready.
Okay, yeah. I've been racking my brain this whole this whole podcast trying to come up with something that the whole Nora thing. Because my theory was that, it was a cheap theory, crappy theory, but that Erica has Lily. Mm-hmm. I think she took her. But looking back on it, maybe Mike was right that Nora somehow gave her. But why would Nora give up Lily? Unless she was afraid that something would happen to Lily since she's around Nora.
And Nora seems to be pretty sympathetic or an empathetic person.
Yeah, but you don't give a kid away. So okay, yeah, here, take this kid.
There could be a couple things in this, though. We talked about the lens thing. Let's also remember that Nora's main storyline in the finale was some nose ring laden woman is saying, "This is not your baby," over and over again.
That's true. Right.
Maybe that sort of got in Nora's head, albeit it was under dire circumstances where everyone was, charging the gate and Lily almost got trampled on, which was actually a lyric of that song that we were talking about at the very beginning of the episode, ironically enough. But maybe Nora has some thoughts after that of like, yeah, I guess maybe this really isn't my kid. I don't know if she should be raised by another in that regard. And considering the fact that I seem to jinx everything around me, Erica's clearly in a bad place. We've seen scenes in season 2 before where Erica seemed to actually have a really interesting attachment to Lily. She might have her own emptiness syndrome going on and is in her own sort of emotional place, considering that at the end of season 2, John is scared that he's going to go home to nobody. We see Michael is around, but we don't necessarily know what their home situation is like. We don't know if Erica just left John behind after everything at the bridge. It could be very possible that in a moment of need, with all those factors coming together, Nora decides to give up the baby to Erica and say, "This is going to make you much happier."
Also, Kevin's not the most stable guy. He is now, but he was not always the most, he's not really, he's trying to kill himself, but he's not the most stable guy either. So maybe that's it too. Because why would Erica take Lily?
Yeah, I don't know if Erica would be so dire. She, did throw a rock through the window, but that was almost as retribution for what Nora was saying about her. But she doesn't seem as much of a vindictive person to just be so aggressive to steal a child.
I'm convinced that she has Lily.
That's but you the don't. The question is, how did she take her, or was she given away?
Yeah, I don't. I think, going with Nora's history, I'm trying to think of this whole why she's, why is she in on her bike with the doves, and why should she take the notes and just throw them in a bucket, but she doesn't bring the notes with her? Who's sending her the notes? Who's sending the notes? Is it Kevin sending her notes and she's just throwing them in the bucket? There were a lot of notes in the...
Jack, not to let you off the hook here, I feel like you're searching for some kind of... What is the crackpot theory?
My theory is that she... I got Ethan earlier, but that Erica has Lily. Uh-huh. How she has her, I have no idea, but I'm convinced 100% she has, and we'll find out this season.
Do you want to stick with that?
I'm sticking with it, but I'm more concerned... I'm more preoccupied with the whole Nora thing at the end.
Okay.
Because I know we're not going to find out till later on in the season.
So that is Jack's crackpot theory, maybe.
And I'm phoning it in. I don't care.
You're definitely Skyping it in. All right. Well, that's...
And the Skype didn't cut out.
That's right. That will do it for this week's Leftovers with Jay, Jack, and Mike. Give us a call at 385-309-0311.
Call anytime.
Again, that's 385-309-0311. Call anytime with your questions, comments, and theories. Give us an email to leftoversjj@gmail.com. Once again, that's leftoversjj@gmail.com.
Hey, there's an M in there. Gmail, Gmike, something.
Check out our website, jayandjack.com, for all of our other podcasts that we do. You can also go to jayandjack.com/iTunes. That'll take you to all of the other Jay and Jack Productions podcasts, including a new one with one of the fantastic hosts on this show, Mike Bloom and Jeremiah Panhorse, Fargo, with Jeremiah and Mike. Mike, you want to plug that show?
Sure. So Fargo season 3 is imminent at the time of recording this. It's only 2 days away. I am getting, as I said on the preview, my full dose of Carrie Coon this season, both old and young. Carrie Coon is playing a major role in season three. It seems like she is going to be our Marge Gunderson analog here as the feisty female cop. So I'm super excited to see that. I'm talking with Jeremiah Panhorst, who covered the second season of Fargo on Post Show Recaps in the past. Huge fan of the show. If you're not already subscribed, make sure you go into iTunes, do that. We released a preview last week talking about our thoughts on the series so far, talking about a little bit about what we're predicting from the cast and the season, but I'm super excited to get into that and to dive into some coverage there, because from what I hear, it's going to be a crazy season of television as well.
It's going to be cool. I'm still trying to work on a song for you guys. It doesn't mean I don't love you, but I'm still...
Did you hear him say it's less than 2 days away?
I know. Give me a second.
I'm not trying to put any... Maybe you can do the theme from Growing Pains.
Maybe I'll do put the same amount of work into the song as you did into the Crackpot Theory tonight, Jack.
And actually, you're, let's be fair. Your songs have been that way for years now.
Hey-o.
Wow.
This
is just like the Leftovers. Things
Leftovers recap.
They fall apart.
Lost recap. Westworld recap. Anyway.
Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/JayandJackGroup. A lot of fun discussions on there, including posts for TV show discussions, for a lot of ones we do podcasts about, and more. Become a patron, patreon.com/JayandJackIn. There's many different levels. We want to thank especially Molly the Millennial, Tack from Tokyo, and Eckhart Richter for your contributions. See a full list of all of our patrons on our thank you page at JayandJack.com. I think our next goal is a quiz off between all of the different podcasters, and that goal is at $1,250, and I think we're probably about like $250 short. but we did get some new patrons because on our all patrons feed, we also released a new podcast, Owen and Baru's Barbecue. It is a Star Wars podcast.
My favorite title of any podcast ever.
So Owen and Baru's Barbecue, it's a Star Wars podcast. They talked about the new Star Wars trailer and kind of gave a breakdown on it. Actually dissected like every scene from that trailer.
I haven't listened to it yet. Does Nick hate the trailer?
Nick kept his opinions, dialed them back just a little bit. He didn't go full Nick. But the hosts of the show are Chris in Boston from Married Man, Nick from Game of Thrones and Married Man, and Matt of the Three Stupid Guys. Matt has been kind of working on this podcast for a long time, and excited that it is out and coinciding with the new trailer for The Last Jedi.
Matt was also on the longest episode, Married Man episode ever.
Yeah, almost 3 hours. Good Lord.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's...
Couldn't get him to shut up. They just keep
talking. Out of control. All right. That will do it. Actually, Mike, you do a billion other podcasts. Any other ones going on right now?
Yeah, there's a lot. I cover RuPaul's Drag Race, SNL. I'm going to be doing Amazing Race this week as well. I did Dancing with the Stars last week. I'll put it in the short-term message because we've already gone pretty long on this episode. Just follow me on Twitter at @AMikeBloomType. I plug all the great stuff I do there.
Awesome.
What do you think about the Amazing Race, how they stole my idea? What do you think? Do you like it?
I will say, again, not to spoil too much of my thoughts, I love the cast. I think that they did a great job of casting individuals that work really interestingly together. The route itself is a little bit to be desired from, but a show that's so long in the tooth in 29 seasons, you could almost expect that. The cast is what I always come back for, and I feel like maybe my expectations were too low coming in, but the cast has delivered on the entertainment front, in my opinion.
Do you want to punch some? There's one person that needs to be punched.
In the balls?
Yes.
Yes.
What a drama queen. Jeez, man.
Will do it for this week's show. We'll see you next week for the next episode of The Leftovers. Excited to talk about it. Until then, hasta luego and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.